Floor is open for questions. Depending on how many get up, I'll decide how many questions we'll take in a row. Please identify yourself for the podcast.
Hello, Sean Fraser, Department of Foreign Affairs. Just wanted to say thank you for the presentation showing the effectiveness of international law as a preventative force in the international community. Unfortunately, I think I somewhat disagree with your interpretation of international law, and this is not something I specifically worked on use of force in IHL for a long time, so this is going back a while in my head. But I think what you're leaving out is the Nicaragua decision of the ICJ, where they said that customary law and conventional law can coexist in parallel. And I refer to Philip Allitt when he referred to the Nicaragua decision, he echoed Bentham and said this was nonsense on stilts, because the Nicaragua decision has the effect of completely undermining the use of force principles in the Charter, because it says that self-defense can exist, and thus the state practice and opinio juris can allow the states to determine what self-defense consists of. So this opens up the possibility of anticipatory and preemptive self-defense. Anticipatory self-defense, I think, was more widely accepted by academics and states, and preemptive self-defense was, of course, more controversial. But I disagree that preemptive self-defense has not been used by states at all. I can cite the U.S. Against Libya in 1986, Russia, Israel have used it, and I think most noteworthy is the U.S. Use of preemptive self-defense to justify the Afghanistan war, which is evident in the October 7, 2001 letter that was sent to the Security Council President, and which the U.S. refers to the prevent and deter the language of the accumulation of events theory to justify self-defense, which is preemptive self-defense. Secondly, I just wanted to mention the article, the collective security provisions in the Security Council. Here there's the notion that this should attach to the Caroline principles. Sorry, I'm just get these points out. That this should attach to the Caroline principles for self-defense. I don't really agree with that. The Security Council operates basically on different measures that get progressively more severe, we would say, where perhaps there's a letter issued, and then Article 41 is used for coercive measures short of the use of force, and then Article 42 is measures that do involve the use of force by states. This is not self-defense. This is to address threats. So the measures for self-defense, necessity, proportionality, in my mind, do not exist. This is how, again, going back a while. The proportionality that would exist would be more the proportionality under IHL, which would relate to the specific attack that may happen. But I would tend to agree with the later speakers that the UN Security Council is not subject to those rules that were set out in the Caroline case. And finally, the last speaker mentioned somewhat an invocation of the MAD theory coming back. And that was, I find, a little problematic. And also just mentioned that I think the NPT, the strength of the NPT is also in the safeguards provisions. For states, how they use the NPT is principally for those safeguard agreements that control the flow of nuclear information and materials. So I think that's real effectiveness, not so much the realpolitik larger issues. Thank you.
Thank you. Several quick, short comments. Professor O'Connell, I'd appreciate your taking your discussions a little bit further in two ways. First of all, with regard to Article 8 and regional organizations, which are supposed to go to the Security Council for pre-authorization, but we're seeing regional organizations, in fact, suggest that they would take action without that. For instance, the African Union in particular, and that's not likely to be a nuclear case, but it's there. The second thing is, I'm interested in your responses to the arguments regarding the Webster criteria, that they were put together at a time which had technology at a level that allowed that allowed observation and so on, and the adequate perception, if you will, of imminent attack. I'm not sympathetic to the arguments against that, but I'm interested in your comments. With regard to the arguments about general deterrence, I think that's interesting, but it would seem on the basis of both empirical and theoretical literatures that general deterrence is sustained through transparency and rationality. You make both those assumptions or those conditions. I think it's very hard to argue that arms control procedures have not heightened transparency.
Well, Philip Allott was my professor in Cambridge, and I love Philip Allott, but he was wrong about the Nicaragua case. It was far from nonsense on stilts, and it has been carried forward in a number of subsequent decisions by the International Court of Justice, very important ones, in the case of most recently Congo's case against Uganda. So this, you know, I really, really urge you to update and go back and look at these more recent cases by the International Court of Justice, oil platforms, 2004, 2005, Congo, Uganda. These are very important cases dealing with contemporary situations and make very clear that if the international system is going to have a law, if we're going to have law for the international community, we have to have rules governing force. I mean, that's the first thing and the most fundamental thing law does is to control violence, create order by giving to only the authorities of a community the right to use force. And in our case, it's the Security Council with the right to authorize. I'm sorry to keep talking about this book, but I wrote it in part to answer questions like yours. There's important discussion about why necessity and proportionality governs the resort to force, not just IHL. It's written in my husband thinks it's a very exciting book. And he's not an international lawyer. He was, in fact, a soldier and a former interrogator, and he says it's a good read. The Caroline case, I can answer Caroline with respect to both of the questioners who bring up Caroline. I think that the right way to interpret Caroline is as to these points of necessity and proportionality that have to restrict and govern any resort to force. In addition to having, these are related and they come to us through just war theory, right? So under the ancient just war doctrine, you have to have a just cause, but you also have to fight in a way that you have a chance for success and you do not act disproportionately and cause more harm than good. These are ancient principles that have come down to us, get filtered through Caroline in the 1800s, and now we find are definitely part of, I think their necessity and proportionality are properly classified as general principles. The International Court of Justice talks about them in the nuclear weapons case as customary international law. That's probably not that important, but they are very important parts of the law that we need to talk more about and have more understanding of. But there's no question that they are part of the jus ad bellum, the law governing resort to force. Yes, I'm very concerned that this law is becoming diluted and at a time when force is less and less useful for the things we want to do. So it's a real worry of mine that regional organizations seem to think that they can step in and do these things. At least the African Union has said that it can do so only because it has the prior consent of states to intervention by the AU. But it's now been questioned, and a number of us have raised the point, well, what happens if a state subsequently withdraws its consent? If I'm right and Article 2, Paragraph 4 is a peremptory norm, then states cannot use force in violation of 2.4, that's a UN charter. And if a state withdraws its consent to be invaded, then the AU charter would have to give way to that higher norm, and I think that's got to be the case. I continue to be concerned that there's the idea around responsibility to protect, that there's a right to use force in violation of the charter, and a number of us have tried to eliminate that wrong idea, Gareth Evans in particular, even though he helped propagate it in the first place, but he has backed off it. It comes up again, unfortunately, in the new Secretary General's report on implementing responsibility to protect that came out in January, and he, Ed Luck, who wrote that document or advised the Secretary General on the writing of that document, has slipped in once again that the General Assembly under Uniting for Peace might be able to authorize force, and there's just no place for that in the UN Charter, and looking, thinking really in pragmatic terms, how can we advance our world? And it's not through the use of force. This is a really wrong-headed idea that somehow military force is a silver bullet that's going to accomplish protection of human rights or very much else. It's good, in my view, for very few things, one of which is pushing an army like Iraq out of a country like Kuwait.
Do you want to make a brief comment,
Terrence? Yeah. I would agree with the comment. I would certainly agree with the comment that the NPT is useful as a management tool, but if you sanctify it so you can't repeal it, then you have something which acts against the free balancing of states, thereby undermining the functioning of the balance of power. With regard to deterrence, obviously, Brian and I would disagree. Nuclear weapons, if you understand them, are unusable. If they're unusable, you can't use them and they cease to exist, they cease to deter, and then war becomes safe. That's why India and Pakistan could fight with nuclear weapons. Despite having nuclear weapons. It's called the stability-instability paradox. You can only have nuclear weapons with irrationality. Arms control is inherently irrational, and therefore they undermine deterrence.
We'll take both questions and then let the panel respond. To my right first.
Thank you very much. I largely agree with Mary Ellen. Also, I would... I fully agree with the self-defense, while probably one has to be more tolerant with the Security Council for a policy reason, which is just to avoid unilateral use of force, we have to accreditate the idea that there is someone in the world who can authorize the use of force for other reasons, and take a larger policy decision that in certain situations the solution can only be the use of force, unfortunately. Just as I have the pleasure to be in Canada, I wanted to make a remark about the Caroline case. In my view, the Caroline case is not a self-defense case. At that time, there was no prohibition of the use of force, and therefore you would not need the circumstance of self-defense as a circumstance precluding unlawfulness. In addition, no one claims that the U.S. was behind those who sent the forces across the Lake Ontario, and therefore, in modern terms, this would be a case of state of necessity. And in this context, I fully agree with the Caroline criteria, but I'm conscious that somehow the Caroline criteria are today in majority used for a situation which was clearly not the Caroline situation. Thank you.
I just wanted to bring your attention, like, we generally assume... We generally assume that, you know, there is a clear prescription of international humanitarian law which we need to follow, and there's also a distinction between arms control law and international humanitarian law. A lot of people who engage with international humanitarian law, they say they're not actually engaging with arms control and disarmament. So I was wondering if you could comment on the relationship between international humanitarian law and arms control law. Apart from that, in terms of some of the problems with regard to international humanitarian law itself, is very evident in terms of the ICJ nuclear opinion in 1996. First of all, is a distinction between the law of war and the law in war. A lot of people who basically followed IHL say we are basically concerned with law of war and law in war, whereas a lot of arms control treaties, there is actually a combination of both law of war and law in war. So if you could comment on that. Apart from that, there is also this question about whether we're talking about IHL principles or are we talking about IHL rules? This is, again, a point of contention between different participants. And the emphasis on rules is very important because that is where the negotiations of the treaties like NPT becomes extremely important. And that is why, actually, the logic of nuclear deterrence doesn't really always work, because the emphasis on rules is extremely important in terms of fulfilling state obligations. Thank you.
Well, of course, Marco, I agree about, and I didn't mean to say that the Security Council doesn't have the possibility or the right to authorize the use of force, but I do think the Security Council is generally under international law and must respect general principles of international law. And I think you and I have already discussed the fact that certainly the Security Council authorizing force, we should expect UN forces to comply with IHL, for example. But it also needs to comply with the principles of necessity and proportionality. And it just cannot authorize a use of force that will have no chance of succeeding. And as I said again, this is ancient law, and this goes to the point about Caroline, which I think we often talk about how the Caroline will never sink, because we constantly talk about it as always raising the Caroline. Anyway, this is a great myth that there were no jus ad bellum rules in the 19th century until the Hague Convention of 1899, when we started formulating them. There was no positive law. There was no treaty-based law. But people like Oppenheim are just wrong that there was no non-treaty-based, non-positive law governing uses of force. At least most states during the 19th century did still invoke just war principles for governing what they were doing in terms of force between states, and there were very well respected and detailed rules on neutrality and other things. Now, I'm happy to say that the Caroline wasn't a classic self-defense situation, and I really think it's ridiculous when people try to say that somehow Article 51 should be read in light of the Caroline case for the resort to force and self-defense. I mean, that doesn't make any sense, and I agree with you there. But I think it is a useful statement with regard to carrying forward two of the just war principles with regard to not using excessive or unreasonable force, and not using force when except in those situations where it's really talking about something maybe slightly different than I've mentioned yet, or a different formulation of it, where other means, non-forceful means, will do no good. Those means are exhausted. That was actually the main complaint the U.S. had about Israel's 1981 attack on Iraq. Jean Kirkpatrick said that Israel had not exhausted peaceful means, so there was no necessity of attacking Iraq. And that comes forward from the Caroline, virtually intact, I would say. Yes, I mean, you're raising the other questioner about IHL principles and arms control. Of course, IHL is concerned with we tend to distinguish between Geneva law and Hague law. Hague law referring to means and methods of warfare, but this is both part of the jus in bello. So, of course, there are certain weapons that are prohibited and cannot be used on the battlefield, such as incendiary weapons or chemical weapons. And this is an overlap between arms control, where we have a chemical weapons convention that prohibits them, and rules jus in bello, that if you were to use a chemical weapon, you're going to go before the International Criminal Court and be charged with a war crime. So there's clear and complicated overlaps. What I think is less well understood and less well respected is that there's both rules of necessity and proportionality in the law governing resort and the law governing conduct of armed conflict, and we have to be much clearer about respecting both general principles in both areas of law. I can't really comment on the importance of distinguishing between principles and rules. Maybe somebody else can in the arms control context.
Okay, we'll go right and then left.
Well, I just first wanted to add to the general frivolity about the Caroline case, which has never made any sense to me. Couple Irish guys are going to go across the Niagara River and invade Canada, and this is imminent and leaves no moment for deliberation. So the psychoanalytic dynamic of Secretary of State Daniel Webster passeth understanding in that case. But my question meant with a little bit less frivolity, just to put the point of precedent that certainly in the Kennedy School has taken on canonical proportions. What's your read, under your view, of the good old Cuban Missile Crisis? Ted Sorensen will go to his end denying that it was preemptive self-defense. I think it's a pretty clear case that it can be justified only as a as a reaction against capacity, not any war plan unspooling. So would your own logic condemn what the U.S. did through its use of force in its non-blockade, blockade, qua quarantine? Thank you.
Derek DeYoung. My question relates to the cases of Iraq and Syria, both being actions taken prior to the introduction of nuclear material at the respective facilities. How does this affect the principle of proportionality given humanitarian and environmental concerns if nuclear material had been introduced to these facilities? Thank you.
Great. Thank you. And I guess very brief comment and then two questions that follow on the presentation of Professor O'Connell. And the first is, I think it's an interesting take on self-defense, but I would suggest a very narrow take on self-defense. And certainly my argument would be that, you know, a state facing an armed attack is entitled to respond to eliminate the threat, not necessarily in a proportional missile-for-missile way, but if that involves or requires removal of the entire armed force of the other state or regime change, there is an argument to be made. But I guess specific questions, I wonder first if you could comment. You've talked a lot about proportionality as a basis for assessment of self-defense. What obligations are there for a defender? Right? And in the specific context of Iran, you've mentioned placement of what would potentially be legitimate military targets in civilian areas. The militarized nuclear facilities, at least some of the blame and therefore some of that proportionality assessment, it would seem to me, would fall on Iran and not on Israel or the United States. And I guess a broader question also touching on proportionality or the necessity of response. I think one thing that hasn't come up in our discussion about Iran is that this is not development of nuclear weapons in a vacuum. I mean, the broader context is a state that has clearly been funding, arming, training non-state armed group, if you will, that has been involved in an armed conflict with Israel and potentially involved in other states as well. That's not an armed attack necessarily attributable to Iran, but it is a use of force, or arguably a use of force by Iran. And that, coupled with very bellicose statements by political leaders in that state, and coupled with weapons development, starts to make a much stronger case than simple peaceful development of nuclear materials that might be used one day in a bomb. And I wonder if you could comment on that.
Okay. Ruth, Daniel Webster was criticizing the British use of force because it was not necessary. It was, as you said, a couple of drunken of my ethnic forebears. And it wasn't necessary to sink the Caroline in that situation. The British forces overreacted. And, you know, on Cuba, the U.S. tried very hard to not to undermine the U.N. Charter, and they came up with a very complicated argument about getting an authorization from the Organization of American States. And, of course, this started this business of having suggesting that regional organizations could substitute for authorization, which, of course, it could not. So to the extent that the U.S. thought that it needed authorization for the blockade, it went to the wrong party and didn't have it. I subsequently look at it and think that the real error in analysis, or the best case that the U.S. can make for itself, is that a blockade, inviting the Soviets to turn around before they got to Cuba with their missiles, was not a use of force, or at least it was a de minimis use of force in Article 2.4 sense, because it was not a significant attack on a foreign country. And this idea of blockade or embargo is left over from pre-charter times, so that the correct interpretation of the charter. But they didn't have that idea at the time, and they thought they needed this alternative. And in that case, they failed. The U.S. failed. I would today say that if the state's going to do that, now the real problem comes. The Soviets have the right to bring the weapons, and the blockade doesn't move aside as it comes. In the game of chicken, it would have been for the U.S. to pull back and to use the blockade to encourage the Soviets to move back as a coercive countermeasure, but it can't follow through with the actual use of force in that context. And that's where there would have been an unlawful use of force, but it never happened because the Soviets did turn around. You remember that the U.S. did not want to use the self-defense argument in that case. We didn't want to say that the Soviets had attacked us by putting missiles on Cuba because we had missiles in Turkey at about the same proximity, and we didn't want missile emplacements. And this, of course, leads to the analysis that I gave today, that you can't say that just possessing weapons is a threat or a use of force against which you can attack with armed force. But bottom line is that, no, I think there are real legal problems with the U.S. Quarantine of Cuba or the embargo. Just very quickly to Chris Penny, because I have to leave in moments. I never said that. I'm not taking away what is the right of self-defense. International law gives clearly a right of self-defense, and the definition of self-defense is the right to take out the offensive capacity of the state that has attacked you. With regard to Afghanistan in 2001, based on the British case, that the Taliban, the de facto government, were legally responsible for the al-Qaeda attack on the United States, if that case didn't have as many holes in it that it does. Let's say it was a strong case of control by the Taliban of al-Qaeda, giving rise to the right to use force and self-defense against Afghanistan. And yes, the U.S. has a right to eliminate Afghanistan's capacity to attack us again in self-defense. I think even under that scenario, we went too far. And after Kabul fell in December 2001, that was probably the time to end the offensive. I think we wish we had ended it then. With regard to Iran generally, and I'm also not saying, please don't get me wrong, that I think, you know, the fact that I don't believe there's a case for using bumper buster bombs on Iran in response to the nuclear proliferation issue, because of that, I don't think that we should stop trying to get Iran to generally comply with lots of good international law rules, starting with human rights rules, with regard to what's going on in their prisons right now. And the whole, you know, I would like to see a nuclear-free world. I would be far more concerned right now about Pakistan's nukes than Iran's. But I don't get me wrong that I think that we shouldn't be reaching out as an international community to all states that are not in compliance with these very fundamental rules. But I think there are better ways to do it. I think we've got to get back into diplomacy. We have to understand international law, understand how it works, refresh. I know this is very true of the United States. We've lost so much of the art of negotiation, how to persuade. We've put so much emphasis on military force. It's the only currency that's played for so long in Washington that people don't remember that we were able to persuade countries how to do things. There was a quiet, long, patient campaign of persuading Muammar Gaddafi. And he's trying to enter back into, we want Libya to come into the international community. And this case is, you know, with some setbacks, not looking bad. So we have precedents. We have examples of what works. We have to retool, get those skills back in order, and take our eye off this chimera, this false god of military force.
That brings to end of our panel. On behalf of the organizers, the SDF community, and everyone present, let me extend our thanks for the insightful comments of Professor O'Connell and our three commentators, Claude, David, and Julian.